Well, yesterday we talked about the image of God in which we are created. And the image that I chose to focus on, and I realize this is a rather arbitrary thing, is the image of God as a God of love and a God of work. And that with God, God's work is energized by love. In other words, love is the power force that drives God's work of creation, God's work of redemption, God's work in our lives and through our lives and bringing us into connection. And love is manifested in that work. So it's just a wonderful cycle. And it's in that image in which we are made. In my experience, the 12 steps has been a way for me to grow toward that image in a way that was impossible for me prior to discovering the 12 steps. It's not that the 12 steps is the only way for that to happen, but it's a way that worked for me, and I've seen it work for hundreds of people over the years that I've come in contact with. And that's why I'm choosing to talk about the 12 steps and encourage you to maybe explore this path of life as a way of walking for the rest of your lives. The 12 steps are not a cure for addiction. They're not something that are the domain of alcoholics and addicts. The 12 steps are spiritual wisdom. And they're based on the Bible in its most profound sense. And they're a way of tapping into that wisdom in an accessible way. And I think that's the key to the 12 steps. It's such an accessible way. It's just 1, 2, 3, and it's incredibly complicated in a way, and yet it's so wonderfully simple that you can walk in through life on this spiritual path, and it's a way of walking that allows you to live out your creation in God's image. The first step, which we talked about yesterday, is that very heart-wrenching time in our lives when, for whatever reason, and it could be a variety of things, we reach that point in our lives where we hit bottom, where something happens that we realize we are beating our heads against a brick wall until we have blood running down our foreheads, and we decide, I don't want to live this way anymore. I don't want to live this way anymore. And we look for another way to live. So when we read the first step, which I don't have in front of me anymore, does somebody want to read it?
Hello.
Okay.
We admitted that we are powerless over certain areas of our lives, that our lives have become unmanageable.
Mm-hmm. We admitted that we are powerless over certain areas of our lives. We're not powerless over every area of our life. We can make all kinds of choices about all kinds of things. But we all have in our lives certain areas that we get locked in and locked to. And we can't get out of them. We can't get out by ourselves. And that could be all kinds of different things that we get attached to. On the first step worksheet, I don't know if any of you who took those home yesterday had a chance to kind of look through and think about the kinds of things in your own life. But we think about the people in our lives that we become enmeshed in our relationships with, where we're trying to change a person. And the more we try to change them, the more frustrated we become and the more difficult the relationship becomes and the more angry we become with ourselves and resentful of the other person. That's what falls under this big umbrella term of codependence, where we're hooked into a relationship in which we no longer are able to live in a loving, mature, responsible fashion because we're hooked into some other person, or we're controlled by that person's moods, by that person's ups and downs, and we're always trying to fix them. A lot of fixers in the world. We also have certain behaviors that we sometimes have no control over. And if you think often of your New Year's resolution list, you'll hit upon those behaviors of many of us eat more than we need to eat. I was talking this morning at the early Bible study, one of the men was saying that at Holden Village they used to just pass out enough food so the people would have enough to live on during their time at Holden Village. And then all of a sudden they began introducing seconds and thirds, and people began eating more and more and more. And now everybody goes home after being at Holden Village and has to go on a diet. The food is there, you eat it. And it's a crazy thing, and you know you're going to hate yourself when you get home. And yet, you just do it. Some of us are compulsive shoppers, and we buy more stuff than we would ever need, and then we become very frustrated with ourselves. There's all kinds of behaviors. We gossip, and we know we shouldn't gossip. And those kinds of things, we work too hard. Many of us are probably workaholics. We let our lives be controlled by our work. And it's not work that's energized by love. It's work that's energized by something else. And then there are the kinds of feelings, the kinds of inner moods over which we have no control. Some of us worry excessively, get anxious, resentment, jealousy, all of those anger, those kinds of things inside of us that consume us, and we seem to have no control of it. Sometimes we have control. Some of those things we do have control over, and that's fine. We control them, and we're okay. But we all have little areas of our lives that no matter how hard we try, everything we do to fix them doesn't work. And we end up very, very angry, frustrated, empty, burned out, whatever. So the second step, after we've reached that point, and we're talking about the process of becoming, and then life, we see like life as journey and life as process. The second step is we come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can transform us and restore us to sanity. When I first heard that step, I reacted with great indignation. What are they saying? That I am insane? Oh, no, not me. And I really got hung up on the language. And spent a lot of time thinking about how they're just totally trivializing the whole concept of insanity by saying all of these people out there are insane. But then I started to think about what insanity is. And if you define insanity as that behavior which works against us and doesn't work for us, which works against our living in God's image, then I knew that all kinds of things that I did were not sane. Why don't we think about some of the kinds of things that we do and the ways that they make us feel, that make us feel not sane? What are the feelings that are the not sane feelings? Just throw out a few of them.
Loss of control.
Loss of control. How does that ramify itself?
For me, eating.
Yeah. Ah, yes.
Eat and feel guilty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. For some of us, it's anger, temper flare-ups, we tell ourselves it's perfectly justifiable. It's everybody else's fault in the world. If everybody else just behaved themselves, certainly I wouldn't have to be angry. But the problem is that the anger is a not necessarily sane reaction to what's going on, because it hurts us. Anger hurts us, and we shouldn't wallow in anger. Were you going to say something?
Oh. Well, resentment is my big one. Mm-hmm. Resentment is not good for me. What it does is it leads to withdrawal behavior. It leads to destruction of relationships.
Mm-hmm.
It causes loss of sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Just all kinds of things. So it's not, it's insane.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a sane thing to
do
or be or think. Or
to hold on to resentment. Yeah.
One of the insane behaviors that I find touches me is thinking on more things than I know I really should.
Uh-huh. And then you can just run, and you feel very important, and you feel very good about all the things you're doing, and all of a sudden you realize, I'm not really doing anything very well, and I'm overcommitted, and I'm tired, and I'm not nurturing myself, but yeah, oh yeah.
That's the same as workaholism. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's important to keep in mind that there are degrees of everything,
yeah.
You know. There are degrees of everything. A lot of the things are very self-correcting. You know, we find that we're behaving in a way that we don't like, and we say, okay, I'm going to quit doing it, and we quit doing it. And that works. But whenever we find that there is some area of our life that we don't like, and we try to quit, and we try, and we try, and we can't, then we know that we're in the area where only God can come in, where our Creator is needed to recreate in us something new. Recreate in us something new.
Perfectionism or fear of failure.
Ah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The title of this lecture is The Desire to Be More Than God. And I think that many of us are hung up on that. We want to be more perfect, more capable, more fixing, more, have better results than even God has had in dealing with us, you know. And we're going to look at Jesus, a few of his comments after a little while. I want to talk a little bit more about, for those of you who weren't here yesterday, about Gerald May's book, Addiction and Grace, and it's one that I strongly recommend to all of you. May is a psychiatrist, and he began looking at alcoholics who he had been treating for years and with zero success. And then they would go off to an AA meeting or for a time and get fixed. And it was very frustrating to him and made him very angry. but unlike many psychiatrists, he was very open to search out and to approach scientifically what it was that was happening at AA groups that made them work when in fact psychiatry was not working. And his theory was that we all have within us two self-destructs. One is the process of repression, which psychiatry is designed to help with. And that's an important thing, and it's an important problem. And for people who need that, that's something that's well worth doing. We also have, though, the problem of attachment, that we spend our lives going through life. For some reason, something works for us and feels good. And so we start doing it, and we start doing it. And pretty soon, the more we do it, the better it feels. And at some point, and you know, we don't really ever know quite where that point is, we get stuck to it. And we can't get off. And then it's become an attachment that is problematic. The things that May talked about as being areas of attachment range from just the very silly, foolish things that no attachment is a good attachment, number one. But, of course, there are degrees. Some things are much less problematic personally and socially than other things. Some people are addicted to chocolate. I don't think there's any way that we can compare a chocolate addiction to a cocaine addiction, as far as its destructive nature on the human being and on relationships. But on the other hand, every addiction, every attachment that we have diminishes our freedom, diminishes our ability to grow, diminishes our chance of becoming like the image of God in which we were created. That our work is energized by love, and love is manifested in our work. I want to tell you about an addiction that I discovered I had a few years ago, and just to show you that this is a really silly thing, and yet some of these things that are really not major life-threatening things can be very frustrating things to live with. And it's this kind of thing that the 12 steps, when you know how to walk that path, is so able to help you process. And once you discover something and label it, then it's like, oh, okay, now I know what to do. Let go. Turn it over. I realized a few years ago that I was addicted to affirmation. And you may say, well, everybody needs to be affirmed from time to time, and that's true. But what the way it ramified itself in my life is that I was continually setting people up to tell me how wonderful I was. And I did this especially to my husband. And he would sometimes fall for it and often wouldn't. And then I would get very angry. He was not meeting my needs. He was at fault, you see. And I would never tell him what my need was. I would just say, what do you think of my new dress? You know? And he'd say, I don't like it. what did you think of my talk? Or whatever it was. I'd give him things I'd written, you know? And he'd say, well, you know, you misspelled a word here, and there's this problem, and there's that problem. And, yeah, it seems okay. And, you know, that's not what I want, honey. But I would never tell him, see? Because I needed my fix. And I needed to get it in a way without asking for it. It ramified itself in my maintaining friendships with people that would give it to me, even though the relationships were not necessarily healthy. It ramified itself with my students in the college classroom, where I would play for the course evaluations, you know, and I was not necessarily honest with my students because I wanted to be sure that at the end of the semester they would sit and say, oh, great, great, best teacher I've ever had, you know, all this kind of wonderful stuff to give me my fix. When I realized that this was, in fact, that I was hooked on it, that it was perverting the way I was living, that it was making me be dishonest in many of my relationships, I turned it over to God. I just let go of it. And it didn't take very long before, and I made some conscious choices. I told the friends that I had been getting my fixes from that I wanted them to quit. I just wanted them to quit telling me how wonderful I was. No matter what I said or did, don't do it. Well, that's not necessarily the best thing to do because then you're putting responsibility for your own growth on somebody else. But that's one of the things I did. Anyway, it always makes people very uneasy when all of a sudden you change the rules of a relationship, you know. So I explained what was going on in my life and what I needed. What's happened since that time is that now affirmation is for me not a fix, it's a gift. Criticism is not devastating. It doesn't put me in withdrawal. It doesn't make me cry and lose sleep and, you know, all the kinds of things. I can get a bad student evaluation and I could just put it in the drawer and say, well, you can't win them all, you know. It isn't devastating to me anymore because I've let that go. That's a small example. It doesn't compare in many ways to the kinds of life-threatening addictions that you know, we have and that many of us struggle with. But it's an example, I think, of how even in little ways we have this ongoing process of just hooking on to something. Hooking on to something. I'm in academia, and I have friends who are security addicts. And, of course, the system provides enormous security once you're tenured. And so they absolutely sell their souls to become tenured. They spend years of their life doing things that they know are without value, that are not what they would want to do, not what they would want to be spending their time on, in order to get that security that they need because they can't live without security. I had a friend who was denied tenure. And she went into a depression, a withdrawal depression for months and months and months. Now after about, and then got hooked into a 12-step group and was able to process this through. And now she looks back and realizes that being untenured was absolutely the best thing that could have happened to her because it brought her into the 12-step path and helped her look at those issues in her life. I think this is true. I have some of my family sitting back there, and I hope I can say without a smidgen of doubt that all of us now look back on Per's addiction as a good thing? Wouldn't you say? Yeah. And at the time when we were going through these years of hell with this older brother, in the case of these two sisters, who was horrible, and a son who was just a disaster, you can imagine what it was like in a small town of 5,000 people with the pastor's son, the local drug pusher. You know, this is not fun times. And yet we all look back on that now as a gift, because for all of us it brought us into a way of living that has given us a freedom that we never knew existed before, a path that we never knew existed. And it's my hope that maybe for some of you, you won't have to go through such awful times to accept this way of life, this way of living, the spiritual life. We talked last time about how most people are addicted to some self-image, and that's a very important addiction to deal with, or an attachment to deal with, because if we're hooked into a self-image, we can't grow. And so that's really important. Many of us are hooked into a God image. And if you've had an inclusive language fight at your church, or any kind of the change of liturgy, change of language, change of hymns, any doctrinal alteration, you know how angry people can get if their image of God, their image of theology, their image of right and wrong is in any way threatened. And this is when people are attached to a truth, to a concept, to a word. In our congregation, it was the masculine language for God. And you can't believe how angry people became at the thought that God could be referred to in any way other than Father, King, Lord, masculine terms. These are all unhealthy things. They all inhibit our growth. They keep us from living out the wonderful image of God. What I want to do for a little while now is to spend some time talking about what the symptoms are. There are five of them that will help you to know if some area in your life has moved into that area of attachment, if you're stuck there. The first question that you'd want to ask yourself is, do I ever get enough? Do I ever get enough? Can you look around your house and say, I have enough? Can you look at your bank account and say, I have enough? Can you eat and leave food on the table and say, I've had enough? That's my daughter that tonight at supper time, I was just ready to, you know, you don't want to throw away food, right? And so I was ready to fill up my plate again, and she said, Mom, and you're right. <yeah. laughs> Is a compliment or two satisfying, or do you never get enough? You know, do you keep wanting people to affirm you? Ask yourself the question, in any area that you're concerned about, do you ever get enough? Or are you always kind of out there, you know, you temporarily feel okay and then just, you know, looking for the next one? The second question has to do with withdrawal symptoms. And we often think of withdrawal in the classic terms of delirium tremens and shakes and all of those kinds of things that we associate with withdrawal from drugs or alcohol. But withdrawal has all kinds of symptoms. When you don't get this particular thing or person or whatever, does something happen inside of you? Do you become anxious, sleepless, sleep too much? Do you somehow in your body feel different? Do you go into some kind of withdrawal when you don't get what it is that you need? The third question is, do I have a whole system in place for justifying my feelings and attitudes or behaviors? And of course, that's a very important system to get into place. So you you surround yourself with people who think the way you think. You always see people who have more, who do more, who, you know, I have a brother-in-law who's an alcoholic, but he always says, well, I never drink before noon. And he's managed to convince himself that as long as he doesn't drink before noon, he's not an alcoholic, because his father was an alcoholic and his father started drinking in the morning. So anybody with an attachment to something finds some way to convince themselves that this really is okay behavior, and usually by surrounding yourself with people who are also involved in the same kind of behavior, or people who will help you justify whatever it is. The fourth question has to do with loss of willpower. Have I made resolutions to myself over and over and over again that I'm going to quit doing this? And yet somehow you just can't. Have I told myself over and over that I'm not going to feel resentful? And then something comes up and all of a sudden you just feel this burn inside. Have I tried very hard not to feel jealousy? Have I talked to myself and said, no, there's no reason for this, and there, you know, I should look at it this way and that way, and you do all these mental games with yourself, so I should not feel jealous of this person. I mean, who knows what's going to happen in the future? I mean, everybody has their time, and da-da-da-da. But still, a friend of yours gets an award, and all of a sudden, jealousy just rages up inside of you, you know. That loss of will power to control this behavior or this feeling. The fifth question has to do with distortion of attention. Do I find myself focusing on this thing way more than I ought to be focusing on it? Does it distort my attention? If we are made to live in the image of God, where love energizes our work, and our work is, and love is manifested in our work, and our work is energized by love, so that the tasks of the day are all love tasks, then other things that take our attention, that just grab us and keep us, are things that we've lost control over and that we need to really look at. And it doesn't make us a bad person. This is an absolutely universal human phenomena, and it happens to all of us all the time. The second step, which is we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves can transform us to sanity and restore us to sanity, is what we call the hope step. And yesterday after our lecture, some people said, well, are you just going to leave us here? You know, I mean, is this where we're going to stay? And of course the answer is no. The wonder of the 12 steps is that nobody needs to stay attached. That the whole purpose of connecting with our Creator is to have our Creator recreate in us in a way that frees us from the bondage of sin. How many Sundays do you say that? Did you ever understand what that means? The whole metaphor of these attachments as being like slavery, like bondage, which is the whole, if you think of the Exodus story as metaphor, it's a perfect metaphor for recovery, for addiction and recovery. The Israelites went to Egypt because they had a need, and it solved that need, and it was a good thing to do. It's a good thing to do. Like taking a Valium might be a good thing to do at a certain stage in your life. But then it starts to feel good. And sometime while the Israelites were in Egypt, and they didn't know when, and they had no control over when it was going to happen, something happened, and they lost their freedom. The rulers changed, is what happened in that case. They lost their freedom, they couldn't leave, and they became slaves. And it took an enormous act of God to bring them out of slavery. That's what the 12th step tells us, that it takes an act of God, it takes God in our lives to unhook us, to free us from the bondage of this particular attachment. It's very easy. The whole process of coming to believe is difficult if our lives are in a muddle. I know during the years when Per was in the worst of his drug phase, the only book of the Bible that made any sense to me was Job. Otherwise, I didn't even want to hear it. I didn't want to read it. Anything that was hopeful seemed like rubbing salt in the wound. What the second step tells us is that gradually we need to come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can transform us. And that too is a process, and it takes sometimes a long period of time, and it takes testing. It takes testing. And God will prove worthy. So that you live as if there is a God who cares for you. You live as if there is a God who cares for you. And all of a sudden your eyes will start to change. It might take weeks, it might take months. And you will begin to see God at work in your life. And that this valley that you have been walking through has in fact been a time when you can be broken and then resurrected, transformed, made new. This step is in some ways much easier for somebody who's addicted to drugs or alcohol to take than it is for some of the rest of us. Many of us could muddle through all of our lives living the way we live. And we would be like almost everybody else. We would just be living life. But it wouldn't be the abundant life. It wouldn't be the living fully in God's image. It wouldn't be the free life that we've been promised. The 12 steps has nothing to do with ultimate salvation. The heaven and hell kind of thing. It has to do with the heaven and hell on earth. And it has to do with claiming the salvation that God has given to us as something for the here and now. Claiming the kingdom of God that we've been given for the here and now. And that all begins with admitting that we can't do it ourselves and that God has to be at work. God's dearest and deepest wish for all of us is that we would let God in and let God begin working in us to transform us. God's dearest and deepest wish for us is that we would open up our hands and let God give us what God has promised to give us. And those are all of those wonderful spiritual gifts. How many of you know the list? Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Think about it. Think about a life lived with all of those gifts. And that's what God has promised us, and that's what God wants to give us. But when we're like this, when we're holding on, when we're struggling, when we're trying to fix and trying to control and trying to do, there's no way that God can get in. So we have to just kind of, open up a little bit. God can sneak in. What I want to do tonight is to leave you first with an image of Jesus, who for us is our window of God, or to God. It's not hard to imagine how he must have struggled with the notion of letting go, how he must have wanted to heal all the sick people in the world, how he must have wanted to stop all the wars, to bring peace to all of the nations, justice to everyone. But he discovered, as we discover, that all we can do is what we can do, and our desire to do more makes us want to be more than God. And it's that desire which is one of our most difficult and deadly attachments, that desire to be more than God. I want to read for you a couple of verses from Luke. And they're beautiful verses. They are very similar in a way. The first is in Luke 13:34. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often have I desired to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, but you were not willing. And then in Luke 19, 41 and 42, as he came near and saw the city, he wept over it, saying, if you, even you, had only recognized on this day the things that make for peace, the things that make for peace. And so as we think about all that we're trying to do, to fix, to control, it's important to keep in mind Jesus, who wept over Jerusalem, thinking, if only you would have accepted the gift, and that our desire to be more than God is keeping us from accepting the gift of peace that God so wants us to give us. If you only knew what peace I could give you. I want to pass out a sheet that is a little bit of a revision of something that I picked up at a treatment center somewhere. There was never a name on it. This is not original. I don't want to be taking credit for something that isn't mine. What I want to do first of all is to go around. We could just start here in front. Those of you who are coming back on Thursday, would you bring this sheet back, because we're going to be doing the flip side of it. I'm trying to conserve paper by having things on the flip side. So why don't we start over here maybe and read the first one and just go down the line and read these out loud. And as you hear them being read out loud, think about which one of these or which two or which three seem to strike you as being something that you need to work on in your own life. Okay? Do you want to start?
Got some more copy?
No, I don't. I guess you're going to have to share. They told me that 25 copies would be plenty. Okay, go ahead.
Letting go does not mean I stop caring. It means I cannot do it for someone else.
Okay, letting go means I do not stop caring. It means I can't do it for someone else. When we're talking about letting go, this is what it means.
Letting go is not to cut myself off. It is the realization I cannot control another.
Okay.
Letting go is not to enable, but to allow learning from natural consequences.
Okay.
Letting go is to admit powerlessness, which means the outcome is in stronger hands than my own.
Mm-hmm.
Letting go is not to try to change or blame another. It is to make more of myself.
Okay.
Letting go is not to care for another, but to care about, not to be responsible for, but to be responsible to.
Oh dear. Does that look like a long-term problem?
How much longer is that?
What?
How much longer is that?
15 minutes. Oh. Okay, what's the next one?
Letting go is not to fix, but be supportive, not to judge, but to allow others to walk their own path.
Okay.
Letting go is not to be in the middle arranging the outcome, but to allow others to affect their own destinies.
Okay, next one.
Letting go is not to be protective. It is to permit another to face reality. Letting go is not to deny, but to accept.
Okay.
Letting go is not to nag, scold, or argue, but to search out my own shortcomings and correct them.
Mm-hmm.
Letting go is not to adjust everything to my own desires, but to take each day as it comes and cherish myself in it.
Letting go is not to criticize and regulate anybody, but to try to become what I dream I can be.
Letting go is not to regret the past,
but to grow and live for the future.
Mm-hmm.
Letting go is not to think I know what is best for myself or others, but to believe that God is at work bringing all to wholeness.
Okay.
Letting go is to fear life lesson, trust God more.
Okay. Fear life lesson, trust God more. Okay, let's get into groups of three. Try to find people you don't know if you can. sorry about that, kids. talk about which of these seem to strike you at some point in because of your own life experiences. I'd be interested in finding out, and I think the rest of the group would too, if there were any particularly interesting things that came out of your discussion. Did some of these seem more apropos than others? Any comments from these discussions that would be helpful to the whole group? There's a lot of talking going on, and now everybody's quiet. Yeah.
Now, we were all three mothers, and it's particularly difficult to do a lot of these things with your children because of the parental responsibility. But for myself, the one that was, you know, to nag and scold and argue, but to look for the search out my own shortcomings and correct them, I think that's one of the hardest things to do. Because I don't want to admit it.
Yeah, yeah, right? Not me. Surely not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the good that I would, I don't, and the bad, all of that stuff, yeah. Yeah, I know. What other things came out? Anything anyone wants to
share? Two of us in the of the three, well, actually all three of us said all of these.
This is a real good refrigerator piece.
The two of us who are actively involved in 12 steps are encouraged by looking at how we were and how we are now, and that we've made a lot of progress on these.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's nice to get to that point, isn't it? The first time I read this, it was like every one of them was just, oh dear, you know. Any other comments?
I found the strand in our group was letting go to the powerlessness, and each of us in our own experience felt that coming, that we'd always experienced, I guess in the past we'd always experienced something, and we were able to fix it ourselves, and we felt that that we were supposed to know how to fix something, or we had just done it and it had worked before, so that to approach something and come to something where we couldn't fix it or nothing could work, was difficult to admit because it had always worked before.
It always
before.
Worked
that
before, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Happened.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And many people can live long into their lives before they end up really being hit between the eyes with something that they can't control and can't fix. It's sort of an illusion of control and fixing, in a sense, but you believe it. You know, you believe it. Yeah. Any other comments? What?
Archie Bunker.
Oh, Archie, yeah.
Yeah.
Anything else? Yeah.
I talked about one thing that I have done with this for a while now is when I look at trying to do something for somebody else, particularly my children, I have a little test, and that is, could she or should she be doing this for herself?
Mm-hmm.
And if the answer is yes, and I do it, then I rob her of the growth that she would get from doing it herself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And God treats me that way. In, you know, he doesn't do things for me that I could and should be
doing for myself.
Because he wants me to grow.
Right.
And so, yeah, like you say, I would be trying to be more than God if I were to. You know. And I do still, you know, stumble. Get in there and start doing it for
Yeah. Any other comments? Well, we'll be convening again on Thursday.